COVID-19, better known as coronavirus, has spread throughout the world. Symptoms of this respiratory disease include fever, cough, and shortness of breath. These symptoms may show up 2 to 14 days after exposure. If you're experiencing these symptoms and have come in contact with or in an area with an ongoing outbreak, please call a hotline and/or consult a physician. Clean and disinfect high-touch surfaces. For more information, please visit cdc.gov/COVID-19. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the I Am Cannabis Sativa podcast. I'm your host, Dan Scotland. If you are currently a medical marijuana patient and want to tell your story and be featured on the podcast, feel free to email me at iamcannabissativa@gmail.com. Feel free to hit us up on Instagram at iamcannabissativa. You can also find me on Twitter at icsativapod. You can find and subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, iTunes, Anchor FM, Overcast, Radio Republic, TuneIn, Stitcher, Google Play Music Store, and more. Please rate and review us on iTunes, as rating and reviewing us will bump up the pod on their algorithm and put this podcast in front of even more eyeballs. If you like what we are doing, please become a Patreon supporter of the podcast and support us. Supporting us helps us to keep the lights on, pay rent, pay for hosting, equipment, and travel. And you can do this by going to https://anchor.fm/IAMCannabisSativaPodcast/support. You can also support me now on Patreon at www.patreon.com/ICSativaPodcast. You can support this podcast for as little as $1 a month. We also have a $5 tier if you're feeling extra generous. A special thanks to our current patrons and supporters. Shout out to friends of the show Reefer Revolution for supporting the podcast. Shout out to our new Patreon and friend of the show, Gracie Gatto. Shout out also to Joy One Love 420, also a friend of the show and founder of Keystone State Reviews. Becoming a Patreon or financially supporting us through Anchor, Patreon, PayPal gets you perks like early episodes, exclusives, and shout outs at the beginning of every episode. We also have been recently syndicated by friend of the show, Russ Belfill, and will now be featured weekly on Radical Russ Radio right before his show from Monday 7 a.m., Tuesday 9 a.m., Wednesday 11 a.m., Thursday 1 p.m., and Friday 3 p.m., all Mountain times. And without further ado, let's get to the episode. Howdy, howdy, Kelly.
Hello.
Hey.
Thanks for making this work.
Yeah, not a problem. We always like talking to new people and getting a feel for what hemp and what cannabis is like in various states and countries.
That's awesome. I love it. And it sounds like you all have been doing some important work there. And so are you in New Hampshire?
No, I live like 10 minutes away, but I do a lot of work, and stuff between the two states, like New England, like all the six states are pretty small and they're pretty easy to get to, so people are always doing business, travel, errands in the various other states. And I've been doing like New Hampshire doesn't have a sales tax, so I do a lot of like my main errands there. So nice. Yeah.
I don't know if you know folks in the Massachusetts area, but one of my friends, Ellen Brown, was also, I saw on Facebook, testifying for New Hampshire. So she's definitely a mover and shaker, a leader in that area. So she'd be a good contact for you.
The name rings a bell. I'm pretty versed in the New England cannabis scene, so I think the name rings a bell. Does she do like what's the name? Does she do sort of like seminars or something like that, or is that someone else?
Yes, yes. Sense of Mia seminars is, yeah.
Yes, yes, I've heard of
that. That's what she does.
Yeah, I watched an interview that she was in, like, I want to say a few weeks ago. She was on the Rick Nias show. I don't know if you've heard of him, but he's a New Hampshire cannabis advocate.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the circles run tight. I met Ellen in Colorado back in 2016. So
small world.
It is.
So I read about your background and you know, your what you do and everything, and pretty fascinating sort of background. You mentioned on the site that your dad worked in sort of hemp eradication. So that sort of leads me to like my first question. I learned about this like a few years ago, but like I was learning that like in a lot of like the Midwest, like there are feral hemp like throughout the Midwest, like during like the war effort, like America was growing a lot of hemp, you know, for the war effort. And then when Reefer Madness reared his head in the after the 40s or whatever, you know, they started trying again to try to get rid of a lot of the hemp or whatever. And so could you sort of go into what your dad's experiences were with, you know, hemp eradication, and is there still a lot of feral hemp in Kansas, and what's been your experience with that?
Yes, so I'll start with the last part. Hemp and cannabis, you know, the plant, it does grow naturally all over Kansas. And one of the studies that I discovered that my dad was a part of, it mapped the way that it started, or the way that they thought it spread throughout the state. And it's really interesting to see this map. It started up kind of by the Missouri River, the northeast corner of the state, and then it just spread throughout. But you can find wild hemp. Farmers call it ditch weed. You know, it's everywhere. And even in the places where it's considered drought areas, because a lot of part of the state, the central and western part of Kansas, doesn't get a lot of precipitation. And we know that hemp is so robust that it thrives even in those types of environments, even some not great soil, compared to other crops like corn and soybean that are not doing well right next to it. So we know that it does grow well throughout the state. And you're right, there were the major war effort that did, you know, drive farmers to grow it. And then of course, you know, later they were not allowed to and dissuaded from it. And something that I've been trying to drive is the fact that we need to be allowed to research hemp in the state that is already naturally occurring. We've not been allowed by statute to study the genomics and the makeup of what's naturally occurring, because I think we will find that some of it has just been so naturalized that it may be you know, equivalent to what indigenous cannabis could have been to the region, because there are genetics that are from here originally. We had some brought in from the Dutch and other, you know, immigrants that came in and grew it. But it will be interesting to see, I think, as laws progress and as the scientific advancements progress, that we can identify genetically what we actually have here, because we know it's very, like I said, it's really robust. So going back to, you know, what my dad was involved with as a biology student at K-State, which is the first land grant university in the country, was Kansas State University. They have a very strong and you know, deep-seated education department around agronomy, agriculture, and all of the related fields. And so Kansas is also in the middle of the animal health corridor, which is where the largest percentage, it's like 56% of the world's research around animal feed and animal health and everything that deals with animal science is within the corridor of Manhattan, Kansas and Columbia, Missouri. So we're primed and positioned very well to utilize something like cannabis. But you know, my father at K-State, he just as a volunteer student, he was a part of these studies where the lead researcher, the graduate assistant, and an assistant professor, they wanted to find out certain questions and hypotheses. And so one of those studies that my dad directly helped with was they wanted to find the best ways to kill hemp, or what they thought was marijuana or high THC cannabis. And come to find out it wasn't. And when I discovered these full text publications in 2017, I realized that this was proof that showed what we thought, what prohibition was trying to limit, was not backed by scientific observation or scientific evidence. Because they one of their conclusions was there's a drug type and there's a fiber type, and yet they enacted the Controlled Substance Act that outlawed both, or you know, all forms of cannabis, right? And one of the other things that I found interesting is these studies were ultimately funded by Eli Lilly and Elanco Manufacturing Company, which is it's a global pharmaceutical and chemical conglomerate. So looking back into the early 1900s, I'm going to take a leap here again. Eli Lilly was one of the large manufacturers of cannabis products. I mean, before when it was within the U.S. Pharmacopoeia, and there were, you know, cannabis medicines made, and you know, people just like cocaine and other products, they were found openly. Eli Lilly was one of those manufacturers, so they knew early on the benefits. They had patents on these chemicals, things like that, and yet later, here in the 70s, they were funding studies to eradicate hemp and ultimately cannabis. So my dad was very closely involved as far as the eradication part. He strapped tanks of 2,4-D to their backs and sprayed fields of hemp, which, you know, 2,4-D is phased out now. That's something that they know it has known health condition attributes.
So is it like DDT or something like that, or
2,4-D was the chemical that was used? But yeah, it's along the same lines. I mean, it's a serious chemical, and they did other types of methods too. I think he said that they tried to burn it, they tried to infest it with pests and grasshopper, you know, all kinds of things. But they went around to farmers' plots within Riley County, where K-State is located, and tried. One of the things that stuck with me when he was telling me this originally, when I was about 13, I remembered specifically him saying that whatever we tried to do, it would always come back. We couldn't really get rid of it. And that to me was like, okay, well, there's something to this. And there's also something weird that we're trying to kill something that we know grows well, because that just doesn't make sense. Yeah. And I have family who farms. And my dad was part of a crew that farmed all up and down the Midwest during the wheat harvest. So, I mean, I've spent a lot of time on a farm, even though I'm from a city. And I got to tell you, I mean, when I put the things together that this shouldn't be outlawed, and yet all of our farmers are suffering, and you know, commodity prices are not going well, and you have these tariffs with other countries and all this, I was like, we need to change all of this. And so that's kind of my connection is I discovered this data that my dad was a part of, and things have kind of happened from there. So I advocate, you know, at the state level, and have been involved with some regulatory work and things like that. And yeah, it's all very fascinating to me. So I could talk about it for a long time. I know you can as well.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, it's crazy that how much like resources they spent to get rid of something that grows naturally, that benefits the environment. Like I was even reading something that bees, like the disappearing bee population, which I've been hearing about since like I'm in my early 30s. I've been hearing about the disappearing bee population since I was in high school in the mid aughts or whatever. And it turns out bees like hemp, and they like the cannabis plant, and like it can help rebound their population. Like there's just such a huge amount of good that hemp can do. And it's just crazy that we have all these politicians that are, you know, and companies as well that want to keep it illegal, whether it's, you know, cop unions, whether it's big pharma like Eli Lilly, like you were just saying. It's really crazy that we're being prevented from having this. And especially because like people are not smoking cigarettes or tobacco as much anymore, the farmers still need work, at least like they still need something to do with their land, and like allowing hemp would really, really go a long way. From what I read, they were saying that like in Kansas, that like I think the period started for people to apply, I believe, like was it January or whatever, like early January when people could start applying for grow?
Yes, for 2021, that is correct. And the deadline is in March. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And we've now kind of moved into the commercial hemp field as other states are still in the research phase. But the Kansas plan was adopted by USDA. And so we have moved into the commercial, and then they're looking at, I think, a few different changes, maybe administratively or in the statute realm. And then it'll be interesting to see what happens with the federal level, because you know, with a new administration, I guess they're not pressing pause on it, but they are taking a look at the final rule that came out. And Kansas needs to be able to match that federal level, because there are a few different things within it, such as the, you know, THC threshold and things like that, that we need a lot of help for farmers in that regard. So hopefully we can get those things figured out moving forward.
For sure. So I feel like you touched on this a little bit earlier, but I just wanted to sort of like ask, like, I mean, I live in Massachusetts, so I haven't, like, I think the first, like, I've been to California, like, once, in Washington State once, but I haven't really been, like, too deep in, like, the Midwest. So what's the weather like in Kansas for those outside of it? And in regards to how it relates to growing hemp, I would imagine, like the western portion near Colorado is probably a less hospitable place to grow hemp, or I'm not sure, but I just sort of wanted for those of us sort of on the outside, like what are the conditions for growing hemp, and what are like the ideal places in Kansas to grow and cultivate hemp?
That's a great question. So one of the great things about Kansas is we have a very, very diverse kind of layout of soil type and precipitation zone and climate zone and all of that. But it's all relatively, you know, the same as far as climate type. So Kansas, you're right, in the central and western part of the state is more arid. There isn't as much precipitation. They don't get rain as often and as heavy. And it also gets missed for a lot of weather patterns during the winter time too. So it requires, and I think more increasingly so over time, they have just completely drained the aquifer. The Ogallala aquifer is the main source of groundwater for those farmers out there. And they have been growing corn and other types of crops that are very water intensive. And so they've been draining the aquifer for generations. And I mean, tillage in itself is the thing that caused the Dust Bowl from back in the 20s. Is if farmers weren't tilling and constantly getting up all of that debris, it wouldn't have gone airborne. So all of the principles of regenerative agriculture, like cover crops, you know, permaculture, no-till and never-till, all of these things that hemp grows very well with, those were taken out of the repertoire of a farmer, and they didn't use those tools for too long. And so what we're looking at is, you know, a region of the state that is heavily depleted as far as water goes, so they need something that's drought resistant. And their soil type is kind of sandy loam. It is not ideal for some crops, but does work for things like hemp. And what we found is that in the first year, so Kansas first got to grow hemp in 2019. And within that year and 2020, over 90% of the farmers grew high CBD plants, so short, bushy plants in a more, you know, medicinal style. And it didn't work for a lot of people, and too many farmers bet the farm on it, whereas they needed to have started research into fiber and seed and grain, you know, all of the other types of varieties. So we're going to see a shift over time, and we're seeing it already. There's some great things happening with Melissa Nelson Baldwin and South Bend Hemp in the central part of Kansas. They're getting into some great research and production capacity for a processing facility on the fiber and grain side. So I think that what we're going to see is, because of the way Kansas is kind of divided in the soil and precipitation, the more fiber and grain, those types of varieties for farmers are going to be more advantageous in the central and western part of the state. Whereas in the western and southwest, we're going to see probably more people growing for cultivars for different purposes. We may still see some multi and dual purpose, but it may be more of the indoor. And of course, what's also amazing, Dan, is that, you know, once we've got genetics for triploid and polyploid that are crossed with autoflower and some really, really inventive and innovative genetics work on them, we can develop crops that can be grown outdoors in 90 days. We can harvest. It won't get cross-pollinated, even if it's in the air. I mean, there are a lot of things that we can do that's not necessarily GMO, you know, per se, but just innovative work that I think needs to happen to move the industry forward. And in addition to you know, closing the supply chain and making sure that farmers have a place to take their crops.
For sure, for sure. Yeah, you answered like a lot. Like, there were other questions I was going to ask, but like, you answered them within that one question. So like, I really appreciate that very sort of thorough response to that. So it does seem that like, that that for the time being, that a lot of the farming and the growing is going to be more for fiber and more for, you know, feed or whatever, rather than CBD, because the farmers haven't acclimated or haven't figured out what are the best things to grow in the diverse soil of Kansas. So it seems like perhaps you guys are going to be like a fiber sort of powerhouse, as opposed to, you know, like other states like Kentucky or Tennessee or Oregon that are growing more for CBD.
I think we're going to see overall, I mean, the industry. So, I mean, I was just involved with a product line that launched during the pandemic, and they were a vertically integrated hemp producer. So they grew their own genetics, got that biomass processed, manufactured their own products, and had retail sales. So, you know, there are people that are still going to do that. And what we've seen, though, over the past several years is there's just a huge gluttony, a massive surplus of biomass and product on the market. I mean, the amount of CBD that could have been produced by one or two farmers could have supplied the whole state for a year. I mean, there's just so much that's out there right now. And that's where, you know, the price is going to continue to decline. And if people want to survive eventually, I we're going to see a lot of changes, I think, move in that regard. And it is CBD growing for high CBD content. It's very labor intensive. And these farmers in Kansas are used to growing field crops, you know, large ag, not in that, you know, small horticulture style that is done for you know, cannabinoid content cannabis. So it's, yeah, I think that Kansas is going to see some changes, but there are always going to be people wanting all aspects of it. So
for sure.
Yeah.
So to sort of shift gears, to medical sort of cannabis. So being out here in the East, like I've heard a little bit about Brownback and, you know, his sort of shenanigans, and we've gone from him being like a staunch like opponent of any medical cannabis reform to now what's the name? Governor Kelly, who supports medical cannabis reform, but then you still have sort of barriers like Dan Hawkins, who leads the Senate that is not really a fan of reform. So could you sort of walk us through like the prospects of medical cannabis, you know, now, and, you know, What were the barriers that Kansas ran into, you know, over the years, and if those barriers will sort of be overcome this year or in the near future?
Yes, well, that's very complex, and that's in short what politics is in Kansas. Is it's very complex and also complicated, but There's a lot that is happening right now, especially, and it seems to be happening at a much faster pace now that Governor Kelly has announced that she wants to see medical cannabis legalized and also pay for Medicaid expansion, which is, by the way, a very hotly contested issue in Kansas, as it is in other states, even though it shouldn't be. It's a no-brainer, but that's been on the books, the holy grail, really, of regulation in the state first. And having a governor now that is tying medical cannabis to it, I don't know how it will be received yet. We think that definitely lawmakers, you know, they want to do the right thing for Kansans and for their constituents, but when it comes down to things like this, they really need to look at the evidence and not base their decisions on beliefs and opinions. And so what we've been trying to do is provide as much education and data, just evidence-based data for all of this. And that's the work I'm doing with the Kansas Cannabis Business Association and a couple different lobbyists. There's a lot of support for it. And we know that overall, this is not a nonpartisan, it's a nonpartisan issue. But there are still people that, like you said, are staunchly against it and have been. There are barriers that I've seen personally firsthand in meetings that included, you know, law enforcement officers and lobbyists for law enforcement agencies that don't fully represent not only the information well, but not fully representative of their constituency within those agencies. So, you know, for example, we know that the majority of law enforcement officers don't believe that they should be pulling people over and prosecuting them for nonviolent crimes. I mean, that's I've talked to multiple law enforcement officers and highway patrolmen across the state. And there are multiple examples of it too, where they don't see it as a big deal. So we need their leadership really to understand that those voices are out there, and also that their peers in other law enforcement agencies, such as, you know, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition or Police for Reform, they have identified that this is something that needs to happen in order to rebuild with our communities. And this is a trust building issue, and that drugs in general should come from the public health side of things, not law enforcement and a punitive approach. So I'm not telling you anything you don't know. I'm just saying this is what we've been trying to educate people in this state on and bring awareness to the fact that Kansas, I'll let you know, I don't know if you know this, but Kansas is the state that receives the most amount of revenue for charging would-be criminals who get cannabis confiscated, because wow. we still have on our books and we actively enforce a law that charges people for a drug tax stamp, which is erroneous. I mean, they don't issue drug tax stamps for this. So other states have made that law in unconstitutional, but Kansas does enforce it, and we receive over $1 million annually from is wow. my understanding. So, I mean, there are a lot of things like civil asset forfeiture that we need to get changed on the books, and you know, just decriminalize cannabis in general. But those are all things that are kind of in the works, and I think hopefully with two bills, one in the House and one in the Senate, and then I think another bill that could be put forth by the governor's administration, that may really put the pressure on people to have a serious discussion about the policy and the details. Because here's the other thing, and this is the last thing I'll say about this, but the proposal by the governor to have medical cannabis pay for Medicaid expansion, the only way that that's really going to happen is if it is a well put together program that is not too restrictive. So they had proposed something like Ohio, and Ohio has had so many documented issues. That is a classic.
You can't smoke your medicine.
It's a classic example of lessons we need to learn from states, you know, that have gone down certain paths. And if they're going to compare it to Oklahoma, we need something like Oklahoma will generate enough revenue to cover a program like Medicaid expansion. So, I mean, there are a lot of other details involved with it, but that's kind of what we're working on. So I appreciate the opportunity to share about. So thanks for asking.
Yeah. To sort of piggyback off that, like you mentioned working a lot with like law enforcement, and that a lot that rank and file like law enforcement folks, like, they know they're wasting too much money on busting people for cannabis, but perhaps leadership, there's a disconnect between leadership that wants to continue, you know, making revenue, want to continue getting overtime or whatever. So what were the sort of conversations you had with, you know, law enforcement, and how do you, what were ways that you got some of them to on your side? Because I went to test, like I mentioned, I went to testify for New Hampshire, because they had bills to legalize. New Hampshire is sort of an island of prohibition. You know, Vermont, my state, and Maine have legalized, and Canada up north has legalized. But the thing is, in New Hampshire, the police unions are the predominant industry in that state. So they've done a lot to stymie cannabis reform in New Hampshire. Because of them, their medical program is very, very restrictive. Like, you can't even get, you have to go to the dispensary itself to see the strains or whatever. Like, they don't, like, you can't really see strain names on menus or whatever. And during the pandemic, they didn't get to have, they don't have delivery cannabis during this pandemic because of the cop unions. And it's like the cops sort of strong arm their way towards prohibition in that state. So I feel that a lot of people in states, you know, throughout the country where cops are blocking cannabis reform, like, I feel like that would be very helpful and constructive to them.
So this is it's a delicate thing, and I can't say that Kansas is different in a lot of regards. We do have, I would say, let's say if we did have a medical cannabis program right now, I could see those types of things happening. I do think it is encouraging that there is somewhat of an old guard that is beginning to move on throughout the ranks. And I'm not saying that people can't change, because there are leadership in a lot of law enforcement agencies that have realized that prohibition really wasn't backed by objective evidence, and it's done more harm than good. I mean, there are a lot of people that think that way. Specifically the folks that have thrown up barriers in Kansas, I can only speak to, you know, because I was appointed to the Industrial Hemp Research Advisory Board, I served on a committee with, you know, someone who was with KBI, and there was another person from, a lobbyist for law enforcement agencies, multiple, I think four or five actually, who was in those meetings. And so I've dealt with, in the regulatory sense, discussions with law enforcement officers, and I can only speak personally. I was the only person in the room that was really willing to speak up and say something about maybe a fact that something wasn't really represented correctly, or something was really more based on opinion versus what the data show, you know, those types of things. And I think that it was important for that to happen. I mean, I've always kind of had this like equal justice sort of thing about my personality. So when I hear things and see things that I don't think are true, I am going to say something, and regardless of what someone's status is. And I feel that was respected in some regards, because others didn't feel like they had the place, or I guess the you know, notion they couldn't do that because of they were representing an agency or something, whatever. I was coming at it more from an independent consumer industry voice, so in support of industrial hemp, which is what we were trying to, you know, it's like law enforcement doesn't really need to be involved with anything unless there's a crime being committed. But yeah. But I will also say a lot of folks in Kansas, not a lot, these particular law enforcement officers and some of their constituents, they don't want to see cannabis legalized in any form. because they have a philosophy, their cognitive bias causes them to act in a way that is not congruent with what reality is. And you know, we know that one state over, the sky hasn't fallen like a bunch of people thought. People thought that, you know, kids were going to be jumping out of windows every day and all this. It hasn't come to pass. And people look at data, or they look at information the way they want to, and not necessarily the way it is. And that's been one of the main barriers to get over here. But it hasn't just been law enforcement. We've also had some an outspoken physician here locally in Topeka who claims that he's an addiction expert and an expert on marijuana, and he really also misrepresents information and is not comprehensive in a lot of the work that he's trying to argue. And so the lawmakers have for too long, just in short, I'll say that lawmakers have for too long listened to the voices that not only don't represent data accurately, but really are kind of on the fringe as far as their philosophy, their outlook on what it is and how it affects our society. So I think that realization is important. And also the fact that this is a nonpartisan thing. I mean, the majority of people want legal access to cannabis. That's just the way it is. So either folks can get on board or not, but that's the way it is.
Mm-hmm. So to sort of piggyback off that, I often hear stories of people like all over the country, like I've heard stories of people like in Texas driving like 10, 12, 13 or more hours to Colorado to get over-the-counter medicine. Being that Kansas is right next door to Colorado, are there a lot of people that are making the trek to places like Colorado? And I've also been hearing, because I was listening to one other podcast, I think they were based out of like Florida or something like that. Like young people in Florida already, like Zoomers or whatever, they're already like they're college. Some of them are already college age, and they're already looking at states. They're already factoring in like the legalization of cannabis into their college application plans. Like they're looking to go to states like Massachusetts for college, or, you know, Colorado or California or Nevada, so on and so forth. Are young people already doing that in Kansas as well?
Absolutely. And yes, people do make the trek to Colorado. And I personally have, I have worked with an organization that has unfortunately moved families out of Kansas to places like Colorado so that they can have access, so that their children can have access to this medicine. And so it is very heartbreaking the amount of damage that we're doing to ourselves by keeping things the way they are here. There was a meme that went around several years ago. You know, there was a kid that stood on one side of the border and he was a patient. And then on the other side, he was considered a criminal. And the hypocrisy has just, it has driven so many divides and caused so much damage over the years that people, I mean, it's happening actively. And again, it's another reason why highway patrol officers still pull over people for out of state tags. I mean, here's a perfect example. My colleague was driving in Western Kansas with a California tag, and it was for a rental, and he was driving to Colorado for work, and he got pulled over by a police officer. And come to find out that officer pulled him over because it had a California tag. And that wow. is that is something that the Highway Patrol has been called on before. And there's a, there was a, I don't know if it's still a pending lawsuit, but there was a lawsuit against KHP because that's, it can be considered unconstitutional to target people from for out of state, especially if it is something very specific, like driving through the state with something that is legal where it was purchased and where it's going to be consumed. I mean, there are issues with that. So it's I have gone to Colorado for since I was little. My family had fishing trips up the Poudre River from Fort Collins. And so I've been going up there since I was little, and it's been very fascinating to see the changes over the years, from the changes from legalization. Back in 2015, when I first went to the National Cannabis Summit, I spoke with someone out there, I think 1 year later, and he said that the population of Denver alone, this was 8 or 9 months into the year. And he said the population of Denver had already increased 1 million people just from the beginning of that year. And it's because of what you just said, people in other states it's tourism, it's people factoring in where they want to go to school. It's all of these things. And Colorado has, unfortunately, and in some sense, it is a product of its own success, because a lot of people who are native Coloradans, they move there and have been there for years. They're all moving now to out of state because the cost of living has increased so much because of tourism and things like that. So it is, it's challenged. Those are issues that they've been facing and will continue to, but I think places like Kansas really need to, we're going to get on board, and once we do, we're going to see even more of a migration towards the Midwest just in general. And I think with Oklahoma, that for sure has taken place.
For sure. I guess one of my last questions would be, what bill do you think I read one other bill that about medical cannabis in Kansas that they want to model it after New Mexico. So what bills do you think would realistically get to Kelly's desk? Like, would something that's more like you can only do pills, vape cards, tinctures, whatever, do you think that's going to be more likely the medical cannabis program that Kansas gets, or do you anticipate them getting do you anticipate a whole flower one being voted on and being signed?
So that's the $1 million question right now, and I think I can't really answer that completely because we have to factor in the human factor. And, we can provide as much data and everything that we can, but when it comes down to it, if people don't think that it's the right thing to do, or they don't believe that it's what's best for the kids within their district or whatever goes into their decision-making, if we can't get over those barriers, then I think it's probably going to be a more limited program, at least starting out. And that's the one thing I think that I need to remember myself, and I'm trying to remind others, is that regardless of whatever's put forward, it's going to transition. All of this is an evolution, and there will be an ongoing transition happening within any program. But, that being said, my hope is that folks are going to listen to the information. They're going to understand it. They're going to read it to understand it and try to identify where the pitfalls are going to be ahead of time, because we don't, especially for conservatives and old, Republicans in the state, they have touted human human liberties for so long, and this is up there at the top with veterans. They need it for PTSD and cancer patients for illness. You know, people need the freedom and liberty to be able to have access to this medicine, and at the same time, it's the right thing to do for fiscally for the state. And so taking all of these factors into account, we just need to put something forward that we're not going to have to go back immediately and use taxpayer dollars, waste taxpayer dollars to fix. And we can put forth a program that, you know, for example, one of them is kind of modeled after New Mexico / Ohio. That's the House Bill 2184. That bill that is Senate Bill 92, creating the Kansas Equal Access Act. That is the bill that I helped co-author last year, and that was introduced. That's the bill that we think needs to be taken up and put forward. We don't know what the Governor Kelly's administration is going to put forward. We're hearing that there may be some bill language later this week on that. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, how it will compare. But it's all negotiable. There are things that need to be included, and we know need to be included. And in order for a program, especially to fund something like Medicaid expansion and its own cannabis, you know, administration program, it's got to be pretty open, and it's going to have to include some things that maybe people don't think that are going to be okay, but really in the end, it will be. And that's one of the things that I'm trying to push forward as well, is we have to have an abundance mindset. We can't be about scarcity. Our state has been so scarcity driven for so long, and we've had cuts, budget cuts, and digging, and you can't bleed a stone. And so something's got to give. And I think this is something that lawmakers can come to agree on, that, you know, this is going to help Kansans in a lot of different aspects. So.
For sure. So I thank you, Kelly, so much for being generous with your time and appearing on our podcast. I'll let you have the last word. Is there anything that what do you want to like plug, or what else do you want listeners to know about what you do, what your organizations do, so on and so forth?
I guess I'll just say, you know, thanks for having me. I really appreciate you reaching out and making the connection. You can find me on Facebook. I'm on Twitter, GreenThumb_1ONE. And, you know, I'm with multiple organizations kind of as in an advisor role. Bleeding for Kansas, or Bleeding Kansas Advocates, was the original organization, and I co-founded Kansans for Hemp. We're on Facebook and Twitter too. And, you know, the Kansas Cannabis Business Association, they're the ones that have really kind of taken up the flag this session and run with things and gotten a lot of traction. So any support that you can give to KSCBA, you know, reach out to them, and, we're making things happen in the state house. So, I mean, there's a lot to look forward to, and, I'm here. I'm always happy to talk about things and collaborate on stuff. So again, just really appreciate the opportunity, Dan.
Likewise, I learned a lot that I didn't know previously about, you know, Kansas hemp, you know, the environment, you know, whether there's going to be more of a CBD sort of craze or more of a hemp fiber or feed sort of craze. And I'm sure my listeners are going to learn a lot too. Again, thank you very much for appearing on this podcast. And I hope you have a great rest of your day.
You too. Thank you. Take care.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
If you find yourself coming around often to my podcast and want to support our humble little project, there are quite a few ways you could do so. Supporting us helps us keep the lights on, pay rent, pay for hosting, equipment, and travel. You can do this by going to https anchor.fm/imcannabisativapodcast/support. You can also support me now on Patreon at www.patreon.com/icsativapodcast. You can support the podcast for as little as $1 a month. We also have a $5 and above tier if you are feeling extra generous. Additionally, if you wish to get in contact with us, you can leave a voice message on Anchor, and you can do this by going to https://anchor.fm/imcannabisativapodcast and click the send voice message button, and I may just play it on a future episode. You can also call and leave a voice message at 617-466-9389, and I may just play it on a future episode. Feel free to join the ever expanding I Am Cannabis Sativa podcast planet on Discord. We've got a Discord channel, and that Discord channel can be found at https://discord.gg/65tg2nr. Again, that is https://discord.gg/65tg2nr. Feel free to check out Sequoia Organics for a great source of CBD and hemp based products. You can check them out by the link https://bit.ly/33fkrv9, and you can enter the following coupon codes for extra discounts, such as dogtreat20, tincture20, 40% sign off ISO, 15% sign off CBD, and that applies to the entire store. And as always, everyone, stay medicated, my friends. Peace out and ciao.